Thanks for listening to the Football Scholars Forum session on football in the Middle East, held on November 14th, 2013. Welcome everyone to this session of the Football Scholars Forum on soccer in the Middle East. And we're very fortunate to have Alon Raab, one of the two co-editors of the special issue of Soccer and Society, with us. And so perhaps we can start in the traditional way, which is to give the author a few minutes to provide some context and make a few comments before we open the field up for discussion. So without further ado, let me turn it over to Alon in California.
Okay, good morning or good afternoon, and thank you all for being part of this show. Reading through soccer literature over the last 20 years, I realized there's very little about the Middle East. It's as if that region didn't exist at all. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of information about the region, every aspect, politics, religion, and so forth. But for some reason, soccer has been completely absent. So with Issam Khalidi, a Palestinian friend and scholar, we decided to try to remedy it. And it's been an interesting process working on the book. It's taken a couple of years, and it's been wonderful to be in contact with scholars, players, activists, fans in different countries in the Middle East. Before I go any further, I just want to apologize. The materials that I sent were an edited form that I edited, and then it was returned to me by the editors in England, who did a good job, except they sometimes use spell checks. So Real Madrid is spelled as a Real Madrid, and even though I don't like that team at all, I can't stand their money and buying every player. I know how to spell their name, so any mistakes are not our fault. In our anthology, we wanted to pay attention not only to political developments, historical developments, fans, media, journalism, but also film and literature, because those were very important, the depiction of the game. And coming up with the book, we've had, we realized, you know, there's certain areas that there's hardly anything written, and despite our best efforts of contacting scholars in Iran and Yemen and Saudi Arabia, those are countries where just in the last few years there's more research from there, but we were not able to get everything we wanted. There was one instance where the fact that I'm from Israel originally prevented a Lebanese journalist from being included. He submitted some really interesting materials, but his editor at the paper over there, his paper in Beirut, told him that he can't do it because of the cultural boycott of Israel. So in our book, as I said, we tried to give a sense of what the game is about in the Middle East. And we were fortunate, or unfortunate, I think fortunate, that in the last few years there have been some really powerful instances and events of fans, of players in the region, whether in Egypt, Turkey, and so forth, really connected to the game. And James Dorsey, in his wonderful blog and other writings, could elaborate on that. I'll start with a little, just read a part of a little story. It's written by a 14-year-old Bedouin girl from the West Bank, Selha Hamdin, and she wrote this and won the International Hans Christian Andersen Award for a children's story, and it's called Hantoush, and it, I think, explains pretty well this passion that people have for football in the Middle East. She starts her little story describing conditions on the West Bank. Her community is under Israeli occupation, so life is pretty bleak. And I'll skip some of those descriptions. And then she talks about the streets are rough and unpaved because the soldiers use them for shooting and training at night. I hate the sound of the bullets and machine guns. It drives me crazy to hear it, and I want to run away to escape. I do not have a bicycle. I do not have a car, but I do have something I use to escape. Get closer, get closer. I'll tell you my secret. I have a flying sheep. His name is Antouche. He is black with long ears and two wings that he hides under his fleece. He only takes them out when I want to escape and whisper in his ears, Antouche, my lamb, spread your wings from under your wool. I sing this in his ear when the soldiers start shooting. Then I climb on his back and ride to the sky. Yesterday we flew to Barcelona. Let me tell you something about the valley of Abu Hindi. There is no soccer field because the land is a minefield. So Antouche and I fly to Barcelona where we met Messi, the famous soccer player with the most scored goals. We played soccer with him for long hours. Antouche, my sheep, was the goalie. I was friends with Messi and his team. We scored 5 goals. Messi wants me and Antouche and his team in Barcelona, but we had to decline his offer as we have to go back to Abu Hindi to care for the other sheep. They are waiting for me. Who else could milk them and care for them? My father has been in jail for the last 6 years, and he has 19 years more to go. Let me tell you another secret. Come closer. In 2 years, Messi will visit Abu Hindi, and we are going to hold the 2014 World Cup at the Valley of Abu Hindi. Together, we are going to clean the field from mines and build the largest stadium in the world. We are going to name it Antouche Field. The mascot will be a lamb. All are welcome. We are all waiting. And that's by a 14-year-old Bedouin girl from the West Bank.
Great. Thank you for that, Alon. Now we have three of us in East Lansing. In addition to me, there's Liz Timms and David Glovsky, and there are 3, 6, 7 members online. Andrew Guest, David Kilpatrick, Ikabo Chipande, James Dorsey, Lindsay Krasnov, Orly Bass, and Stephen Apostolov. Who would like to ask the first question of the members who are online?
Peter, could I just add a few comments to what Alon said?
Absolutely. Go ahead, James.
Yeah, Alon, first of all, thank you very much for your kind words, and hello, everybody. I just want to make a staccato form a few points which I think are relevant. I think Alon was spot on his description of what I would call two black holes. And the two black holes, in my mind, are one, if you look at globally at the at sports as a legitimate field of research, between Rabat and Beijing, there is nothing structural. There are individual scholars, a few sports journalists. There is nothing else. In the those parts of the world where sports is a recognized study, as Alon said, it looks at every part of the world but one, the Middle East and North Africa. One side note on that, I was actually hoping that I would be the first one to launch a research program related to the Middle East and North Africa. I'm probably going to be the second one. Fact of the matter is that Lund University in Sweden has just done that with a very interesting approach in which they're working from immigrant teams and immigrant players in Sweden backwards to the home country. That's the first point I wanted to make. The second point I want to make is that the fact that there is no structural look at, certainly in academia and also not in journalism, at the Middle East and North Africa is all the more stunning if you go back to an article that Sean Lopez wrote in 2009 where he describes this hiatus. Fact of the matter is, and I would argue that for much of the Middle East and North Africa, football has been crucial to the development of the region since the late 19th century, early 20th century. And when I say develop of the region, I'm talking about nation forming, I'm talking about state formation, regime formation, and then obviously all the battles for the various kinds of rights. And the last point I want to make is that if you look at the history of, I would dare say a majority, but certainly a vast number of football and sports clubs, but football clubs primarily, in the Middle East and North Africa, and I include in that Israel, Iran, and Turkey, they were formed with some form of political association. Thank you.
Great. A comment or question from anyone of the folks online? Okay, David Kilpatrick.
Well, I just wanted to kind of start things off the five lines, I suppose, that really stand out for me in the Palestinian footballer's diary, the lines that he wrote in New York. I believe this is, I forget what page number it's on, but he writes, "There is a field that transcends right and wrong. There is such a field. Come, let us meet there on the football pitch." They have to be five of the best lines I think I've ever read in the history of sport literature. And I wondered to what degree that hope that's expressed in those lines really is carried out in Middle Eastern football, or to what degree, conversely, Middle Eastern football really is a battleground for those ideologies.
Well, Murad Farid is, for those who didn't read the passage, is a Palestinian-American. He grew up in New York, Long Island. Actually, when I met him, I brought him to speak at Davis, and he talked about having many Jewish friends with him on his soccer team. And then he became a member of the Palestinian national team when they tried to reach the World Cup in 2006. And he appears also with some other players in some of the films that were made about that team. I think in the context of Israel and Palestine, I mean, you know, your question is great and probably take us a couple of hours to answer. So maybe just a few points about Israel and Palestine. Recently, I was in Israel and I went to Barcelona came and they were invited by the Paris Center for Peace, which organizes, along with some other organizations, joint Israeli and Palestinian teams of youth, boys and girls, which have gone on even during the Intifada. And Barcelona came and was greeted as royalty. The president met them, the prime minister and so forth. And they were supposed to play a game against a mixed Israeli and Palestinian team. But that was canceled because the Palestinian authorities complained, rightfully so, about travel restrictions that were placed on Palestinian players not being able to move between Gaza and the West Bank. So instead of having a unified one game, they went to the West Bank, Hebron, and they also went to Jaffa and played against Israeli and Palestinian kids. To me, that sort of event, you know, summarizes a lot about the mixed developments when it comes to Israel-Palestine and soccer. On the one hand, the game is a great source of unity and hope. If you look back even 90 years, there were Israeli and Palestinian mixed teams of Orange Pickers and Packers, workers at ports in Haifa, in Jerusalem, and so forth. And from the and actually Jewish and Arab teams played against each other into the 40s. There were Israeli Jewish teams visiting Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and so forth. At the same time, there were also, from the beginning, there were also conflicts. And Issam Khalidi, in his article about Palestinian football, talks about some of those with the fact that under the British, there was one football federation, but very soon it was split into two. A Jewish and a Palestinian one. So I think in Israel and Palestine, you know, the game is both a source of unity, hope, but also it is, you know, like everything in that region, an area where there's a lot of conflict. There have been, you know, Israel is actually a country where there has been a fair amount of academic research, mostly by leftist scholars, sociologists, anthropologists. And they tend to focus on, a lot is about the Arab teams in the Israeli National League, especially Sakhnin, the team from the town of Sakhnin. So it's, you know, I'm really interested in those efforts of bringing kids together, Israelis and Palestinians. But there have been battles on the field, even though, in all fairness, during the British Mandate days, soccer games were more contentious when Jewish teams belonging to the different political parties took the field. In Israel, until recently, the teams were aligned by the right-wing parties, the left-wing parties, and sort of the center middle. So that's kind of in a nutshell.
Great. Lindsay, you have a question for Alon.
Hi, yes. Good afternoon. I'm hoping my internet connection holds here for a little bit. I wanted to ask about, and I didn't see it necessarily covered in the issue, but I wanted to ask about the phenomenon of, European or African players playing for teams in the Middle East and how that might impact issues of identity, if at all.
James, do you want to tackle that maybe?
Yes. Could you just repeat the last part of the question again?
Yes. I was asking about the impact of foreign players in the Middle East. I know a lot of them from Europe or Africa play in the Middle East on many of the professional teams. And to what extent, if at all, do they impact a sense of kind of a local or regional identity in the construction of football identities?
James, do you feel like answering that?
Sure. I mean, basically, I don't think you see a lot of European players outside of the Gulf. You see a lot of European players in the Gulf, and the Gulf is a different story. The players that go to the Gulf are primarily players that are over the peak of their career, and it's an opportunity for them. It's an economic opportunity, and it's an opportunity also to shine still in a team that may not be that strong. And I don't think that they really impact as such on identity or other things for the very simple reason that the politics, including the identity politics of soccer in the Gulf, are very different from those in other parts of the Middle East and North Africa. And that has to do with demography, policies and that result from that from the demographic imbalance, primarily national national or local citizens are a vast minority of the population in a fair number of the Gulf states, and that creates a very different situation.
We decided to include literature, and one of the stories we have, or part of it, is from a story which imagines one of the Gulf states making it to the World Cup in France, and the entire population, the citizens of country are sent to France to support their team. While they're over there, all the foreign workers that are back in this country, the Emirate, as it's called here in the story, are taking over. They start having fun. They start assuming positions of power. One of the themes that I also wrote about in the afterword, which will be included when the book comes out, hopefully early next year, is about the growing connection between Middle Eastern money, businessmen, semi-governmental groups, and the game, especially in Europe. And that has been an area that, along with the concerns about the condition of workers building the stadiums for the World Cup, and The Guardian had recently also some interesting articles detailing the horrible conditions these foreign workers labor under. But in the last few years, many of the teams in Europe, it's enough, you know, to watch what's on their shirt, are definitely owned by governments, airlines from the Middle East. And that has caused some concern and problems. Manchester United is owned by the head of the judicial system in Abu Dhabi. He's also the brother of the head of the army and the security services. In the last year or two, there's been a lot of political repression in Abu Dhabi. So here, it is definitely a way to legitimize and sort of kind of like Russian oligarchs also trying to make themselves more pure by owning a team. At the same time, this movement of money and soccer is going the other way also, with many of the wealthy teams in Europe establishing academies in the Middle East and also working really hard to increase their marketing appeal.
Can I just add one little thing to that?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think Alon is absolutely right in spotlighting that. The one thing that I would add is that there are differences in why various Gulf states engage. One, are bidding for international sports events, such as the World Cup in Qatar, but also tennis events in the Emirates, the F1 in Bahrain, and also why they are acquiring European teams, and now, in fact, are building a team in New York for the Major Soccer League. But underlying, I mean, Alon rightfully so mentioned marketing. With other words, it's projection, it's country branding, it's creating and leveraging opportunity. But underlying it, and particularly in the case in Qatar, and Qatar has been doing this very differently from either the UAE or Bahrain, is something much more crucial. And this is soft power in the absence of hard power. And the key to this is 1990, the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. The lesson that the Qataris learned, but also others learned, was one, Kuwait was able to marshal the international community to come to its aid, and the Saudi defense umbrella is not worth the paper it's written on. And in the absence of any hope ever at this point of being able to build a credible hard power military deterrent, soft power is the only thing that there is, and what better tool than soccer?
And coincidentally, Kuwait had qualified for the 1982 World Cup and for the finals. And I remember watching that tournament, and there was a famous incident when France scored a goal. I can't remember if it was the third, fourth, fifth goal in the game. And one of the Kuwaiti officials descended onto the pitch and convinced the match official to call back one of the French goals. So an interesting coincidence and a kind of funny anecdote that may have had broader resonance than I imagined at the time. There's a question here in East Lansing from David Glovsky.
I was wondering, most of the selections in this volume have to do with Turkey, Egypt, Israel, Palestine. I was wondering if there's other areas of the Middle East where football is not nearly as prominent, and if there were any reasons for that.
Any reasons we didn't include it? Or?
No. Any, if there are regions of the Middle East where soccer isn't particularly prominent, and if that is the case, why?
I think soccer is prominent in every country in the region. Some places the game arrived a little later. Turkey. Turkey, it arrived really early, like around 1870, 1880, as in many places, you know, with merchants, soldiers, businessmen, teachers, missionaries. But it arrived, you know, across the region, it's popular. I can't think of one place where it's not the most popular game. I mean, in some places it had to compete with traditional sports like falconry, horse racing, camel racing. In Iran, polo was very popular for many years, horse polo. But it is all over the Middle East. And I just want to go back just for a second to something James said. One of the themes also throughout the history of the game has been the use of the game by leaders, by political leaders, whether it's Nasser, Sadat, Mubarak, Israeli leaders, Turkish leaders, Iranian leaders. They recognize the popularity of the game and have used it both to deflect different times popular unrest, and also to create cohesiveness in nations that often are comprised of so many nationalities, ethnic groups. Iraq, a good example of that is Iraq, when they, in the last few years, they've been quite successful in the international arena, especially their youth teams have done really well, and also in the Asian Cups. And when the Iraqi national team in 2007 won the Asian Cup, there's a great cause for celebration by Sunnis, Shiites, Christians, Kurds, members of other ethnic and religious groups. So that is another one of the themes that we try to spotlight also in the introduction. The game as a force of unity, bringing people together.
Orly Bass from Durban, South Africa, has the next question.
Hi. Yes, I'd like to ask a little bit more on the Qatar 2022 World Cup. There's no specific paper on this reflected in the content, although it is pointed to in the introduction. But I wondered if contributors considered this and the implications for the region, and if not, what are the kind of initial perspectives on hosting of the event in the Middle East? And I'm thinking broadly here, in terms of not only in terms of football, but politics, identity, development, urban development, etc. Thanks.
James, do you want to answer that?
Sure. I think there are a whole bunch of aspects to the Qatar 2022. First of all, as I mentioned, it's really a function of foreign defense and security policy. Second of all, Qatar, of all the Gulf states, is the only state that is approaching sports in a strategic fashion. That is to say, it is trying to make sports part of its national identity, and it is building a sports sector from A to Z. Sports medicine, sports security, the Aspire Academy, and so on and so forth. Qatar, the whole debate about Qatar, in my mind, has been skewed. And I would even argue, go further than that and say that it's based on sour grapes, on envy, on arrogance, and on prejudice. The Guardian article was a superb article, a superb example of investigative reporting, and yet there was nothing new in it. The first time that I wrote about foreign workers in the Gulf and the absolutely horrendous conditions under which they have to toil was in 1976, and there have been many before me and many after me. However, fact of the matter is that if you look at the impact of the World Cup on Qatar, in some ways is very similar to the impact of the European Union on Turkey. With other words, if you would have asked Turks anywhere between 1966, when they signed their agreement with the European Union, and probably the second term of Tayyip Erdogan, they would have said, we need a straitjacket to reform. Our straitjacket is the European Union. For those Qataris who understand that change is needed, the World Cup is their straitjacket. If you were to look, the issue with labor, for example, that's, in my mind, going to be the driver of social, in many ways, of social change in Qatar. If you look at what has changed since December 2010, when Qatar was awarded the World Cup, then one, if you, laws, rules and regulations, including tweaking of the kafala, the sponsorship system, which in many ways makes workers beholden to employers. If you look at those rules and regulations today, they're really not bad. The problem is that there is a total lack of enforcement and implementation of those rules. If you look at the charters for workers' rights that have been issued in the last year or year and a half by the Qatar Supreme Committee that's organizing the World Cup and Qatar Foundation, more importantly, they're actually quite revolutionary. The Qatar Foundation charter explicitly states, and this is important because if you look at the cycle of migration, one of the most onerous parts of that cycle is the recruitment. By the time a worker arrives in the Gulf, including Qatar, he is indebted for years to all kinds of shady middlemen. The charter today of the Qatar Foundation states no worker shall pay for his recruitment. And the foundation is actually, and I won't go into detail, going into a great deal of length to change the recruitment system. And the Qataris, for the first time, are also trying to include workers in various ways in society. Now, all of this is not because they've all suddenly seen the light and have become extremely humanistic and altruistic. What it is part of an effort to fend off the really political demands that are being made by the international trade unions, which involve the right to form independent trade unions and collective bargaining, something which Qatar as an obviously does not want to concede. The second effect that the World Cup, and then I'll end with this, that the World Cup, the awarding of the World Cup has had, that it has sparked debate about the demographic future of the region. It sparked debate within Qatar itself, where the population is, if one wants to really be liberal about it, the local population constitutes 15% of the total population, 6% of the workforce. And it's enabled someone like Sultan Al-Qasimi in the United Arab Emirates to publicly raise at great cost and courage to publicly raise the question of citizenship in the UAE, where the local population again at best constitutes 15% of the population.
I contacted a graduate student from Northwestern University who gave a talk at a conference in England about human rights and the World Cup, but unfortunately he wasn't able to send me the article in time. In addition to what James said, I think it would be interesting to see how this affects women in the region. As far as attending stadiums, being more visible and so forth, not only in the countries where the games are being played, but all over the Middle East. And I tried today also to get one of the women scholars who have been working on issues mostly about women and football in the Middle East, but unfortunately everyone had a different commitment. So I do recommend, though, the website Muslim Women in Sports, which is a very good website, put out by a graduate student from Turkey, and Sertak, I can't remember her last name right now, but and there's also a fine book published by Routledge about Muslim women in sports that came out about a few years ago. But to me, that women's football in the region, that's one of the areas that's most exciting, its development. And it actually has a long history, and women played football in Turkey about 100 years ago. It was viewed along with other sports, especially cycling and swimming, as a sign of modernity, a sign of being accepted into society. And mostly it was played by wealthy women in the cities. So as far as what's happening now, in January, during the Gulf Cup of Nations, the authorities in Bahrain allowed several dozen women to attend the games. They were seated in separate areas. And then Saudi Arabia, you know, what's happening in Saudi Arabia is, of course, really interesting and gets probably more attention than other places in the region. But over there, there's also changes, slow changes in the way women are allowed to attend games. At least they announced that the authorities announced that women fans and journalists will be able to attend matches, though they'll be segregated. And Also, physical education classes were promised in private schools, even though they have to adhere to Islamic law. And there's even talk in Saudi Arabia about legalizing women's football clubs. Right now, there is a league, but it's sort of half clandestine. And I tried to get in touch with one of the Saudi women players and coaches, but unfortunately, I never got a response from her by email.
Peter, can I just make two added comments to that?
Sure.
Along's absolutely right on women. Just two comments. One on Saudi Arabia. Again, Alon is right, but on the other hand, Saudi Arabia at the moment has a Spanish consultancy that is developing its first ever national sports plan. It's a national sports plan for men only. But one reference to look at, and that is really the yardstick of where things are going with regard to women's sports, is the website of the West Asian Football Federation, which I think is waff.org. which in about 6 months ago, maybe a little bit less, issued a declaration that was signed by all Middle Eastern or Arab and as well as Iran soccer associations, with the exception of Saudi Arabia and Yemen. That declaration puts the right of a woman to play soccer, also professionally, on par with that of a man. It mandates that all soccer federations in the region have to have women board members. It mandates funding for women's soccer. It mandates women's leagues and so on and so forth. Now, again, it's nice words. Implementation and enforcement of that is the real issue.
If I could jump in on this issue of women's football in the Middle East, there's a great piece in the collection by an anthropologist at the University of Iowa, Kenda Stewart, and she has this great micro study essentially of the Banat Saknin women's team. And I was struck by the way in which this team operated in a sense with progressive goals in mind at the individual and perhaps collective level, but pursued it through essentially conservative means, in the sense of, you know, within the patriarchal hierarchy of local society. My question for Alon, since Kenda is not with us, how representative is the Banat Saknin team, women's team, in terms of the women's football movement, particularly among Palestinian women? And the second point is, you know, is this a local phenomenon, or is this a trend we see elsewhere in Asia and perhaps the global south? Thank you.
In the state of Israel, there are a few there's a league of women's football, most of the teams are connected with universities. There are a few teams from Arab villages and towns, but they're not included in that league, except for Sakhnin was for a while. It's still rare. You know, when you travel through Israel, Palestine, it's rare to see girls playing, even though you do see some. But and as I mentioned before, the Paris Center for Peace and other NGOs have been organizing many teams for girls, sometimes just Palestinian girls, sometimes Palestinian and Israeli girls. There's actually, surprisingly, there's a fair amount of films about Palestinian women's soccer. If you do, I could send some of the links.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, but there are quite a few short documentaries done about Palestinian women players on the West Bank, mostly in Bethlehem, where most of the players are Christian, mostly students. And they do have a national football team, a women's football team that drew about 10,000 spectators when they played in the new stadium by Ramallah about a year ago. And it's just as Jewish women in Israel and Palestinian women in the state of Israel, the Palestinian women on the West Bank talk about the same things that women also in Iraq. We also have an anthropological study of women's soccer players in Kurdistan.
Yes.
It's the same, the same obstacles, the same barriers, the same prejudices, and it's sort of a step forward and, five steps backwards. There have been some interesting studies recently of even of fans, and there's a study that I talk about in the afterword of women supporters of Turkish teams, and it's called Ladies of Beşiktaş, A Dismantling of Male Hegemony at the Stadiums. And it talks about hundreds of women fans who formed a group supporting the Istanbul team, and what they talk about of reconciling the contradictory concepts of women, football, and fandom. That those are their words, not mine. And they talk about how, gender inequality and violence inside the stadium is actually what happens all around them in Turkish society. So that is one study that just came out recently about it. But it's, I'm encouraged, by the signs. I mean, when I think of women's football in the region 10 years ago, and now it's amazing what progress has been made. But, when you compare it to women's football in America, Germany, Sweden, it's really light years behind, unfortunately.
Thank you. Other folks online who would like to ask a question or make a comment? Go, Stephen.
Thank you, Peter. I really enjoy this issue, and it's important to talk about Turkey and Egypt because those nations really had a crucial role for the spread of soccer in the region. I was a little disappointed. I didn't see anything about Armenia, and this is, I think it's an interesting nation. We can compare it, contrast it with Israel in many, there are many similarities. And I came actually in my research across an Armenian team in Boston, and they were playing actually soccer in the 20s, and some of them were actually Turkish citizens. Probably they fled from the genocide. And the other thing is we can probably the other thing is that there was a disappointment because Armenia actually is really. Has been playing very well over the last few years. There was also a friendly with Turkey, and so I'd like to have the editors comment a little bit on that. Why?
Yeah.
It was excluded.
Thank you. And there's actually been also, the Armenian quarter is one of the quarters of the old city in Jerusalem. And in my research, I found out that there were Armenian football clubs playing against British clubs. And against Muslim clubs and Jewish clubs in the 20s and 30s. Armenia, though, this brings up one of the sections in our, which is my second little, excuse me? Which brings up, this is the second section of my introduction, and it's, where is the Middle East? Kind of like, where's Waldo? Because there's no agreement at all about what the Middle East comprised. If you look at the websites of the American Middle East Association, you look at the British one, you look at the German one, each one has a different number of countries and places. The American one now includes countries in Central Asia, and it's probably because it's a good area to study now with all the ties between the U.S. Government and military and those repressive regimes, and also the fact that they have oil. So, but to me and to, I think, most scholars, the Middle East is maybe 17 countries, from Yemen in the south to Turkey in the north, from Iran in the east to Egypt in the west. When we started doing the book and I contacted At one point, we thought of including also Libya, and somebody from Libya I was able to get in contact with was very angry at me and said, don't you know the Middle East is not Libya? Don't you know we're North Africa? Don't you know anything about geography? And I had to explain to him exactly what I just said now. Of course, you know, the term itself, as far as I was able to tell, was dates from 1850. It was coined by the British India Office. And then in the early 20th century, if you look even in World War II, the American army considered the Middle East to be Turkey to Burma, and the British thought it's only from Egypt to the Persian Gulf. So Armenia, as much as I love Armenian music and I'm interested in that nation as being you know, an amazing place with a rich history and survival, which is unbelievable, we had to decide that Armenia is not the Middle East. Related to this is also the issue of which I talk a little bit about in the introduction, and that's the whole issue of Orientalism, the way the West looks at the Middle East, and I talk a little bit about it in the introduction. So as much as I love Armenia, I'm sorry I didn't include it. We decided it doesn't belong in the Middle East.
Okay, we expect to have a lot of hate mail from Armenian listeners and supporters now. No, just kidding. Other comments or questions? There's still quite a lot to talk about as we've reached the end of the first half, if you will, of this FSF session. Who'd like to kick off the second half?
Can I just add a comment on Armenia?
Of course, James.
Yeah. No, I don't know what the team is that you looked at in Boston, but there is a team whose name now slips my mind. I do recall that it begins with an H, which is an Armenian team that is very prominent in Lebanon. That's one, and really represents the Lebanese Armenian community there. And if I'm not incorrect, has branches outside of Lebanon. That's one. Two, soccer has played an important role in so far more or less failed attempts to bring Turkey and Armenia together. In fact, one of the first in recent years rapprochements was the attendance of Abdullah Gül and the president of several years ago of Armenia of a soccer match between the two countries. And the third thing is much broader, which goes beyond soccer, but yes, there are lots of similarities between Armenia and Israel. Interestingly enough, when Armenia became independent from the Soviet, with the fall of the Soviet Union, the largest department in the Armenian Foreign Ministry was the Israel Department, and it was staffed with Hebrew speakers. They only had one problem. The phone never rang. And it never rang because the Israelis essentially said to the Armenians, yes, you're right. We share a lot in common, genocide and so forth. But there are a couple of things that you don't have. You don't have Jews, you're not Muslim, and you don't have oil.
And Israel and Turkey until recently were very friendly, collaborating with military, joint military exercises, sharing intelligence information and so forth. You mentioned sort of those attempts to bring Turkey and Armenia closer via football, and that was done also a little more successfully in Yemen when the North and South united. And there have been a few articles that appeared in the last year that talk about Lebanon, which is a country I find every country interesting, but Lebanon, the situation with football is extremely unique, where the political divisions in that country, which you know, created the civil war in 1975, are manifested so clearly on the pitch, and every political party, every group has its own team. And James Montague, whose book was republished recently, and that's a good book about his travels in the Middle East and writing about the situation, He has an essay in our book about Lebanon and the politics on the pitch. And lately there have actually been some encouraging signs where a unified Lebanese team, which achieved some success in some of its games, was actually one place where the different factions were able to unite for the common cause. There's also a study that came out recently called War Minus the Shooting, The Politics of Sports in Lebanon as a Unique Case of Comparative Politics. And that's in the afterword. I referenced that.
We have a question here in East Lansing from David.
So last month we discussed and edited a volume on Africa's World Cup, and I wondered if the 2022 World Cup is in any way within the Middle East being thought of as a Middle Eastern World Cup, or if it's just confined locally.
James, would you like to take a stab at that, or Alon?
Sure. Alon, if you want to go first, please do.
No, you could go. I just spoke, so.
Okay. Basically, the answer is no. There is a great deal of resentment against Qatar for the fact that it has refused any proposal to share the World Cup. In fact, if you look at the sequence of the last trip last week by Sepp Blatter, the FIFA president, to the Middle East, he actually proposed it while in the United Arab Emirates and while in Iran, and in fact suggested that Iran could play an important role, and he was forced to retract that statement once he arrived to Doha. So the Qataris have not been willing to share this in any form or fashion. And obviously this feeds into greater unease with Qatari policies, but that goes far beyond the framework of this discussion.
There has been an interesting proposal. It didn't go very far by Israeli and Palestinian peace activists to have a World Cup in Israel and in the Palestinian autonomy areas. That plan came about 10 years ago, and they were shooting might be the wrong term when I describe that area, but they were aiming for 2018, and that didn't go very far because of the political situation right now.
Okay, David Kilpatrick is next up.
Yes, I have a question in particular for James. Obviously, three really great essays on Turkish football. And given that I'll be in Istanbul in 5 weeks, really looking forward to the Galatasaray-Trabzonspor match. I'm curious, especially if James feels that those chapters hold up to what's going on right now on the ground, Turkish football fans, the ultras in particular.
I think that what you're seeing in Turkey is, and by the way, on the first point I'm going to make, you're seeing this in Lebanon also, and that goes to the performance of the Lebanese national team. Both Turkey and Lebanon have been hit by significant match-fixing scandals. They're different in what they represent. In Turkey, Turkish soccer is thoroughly corrupt. But the battle over Turkish soccer is a battle between Islamists. It's a battle that's still being waged, and not only over soccer, but soccer plays an important role in that. And that's the battle between the Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan and Fethullah Gulen, who is a prominent self-exiled imam preacher who is now in Pennsylvania. And if you look back at the way that the whole debate on penalizing match fixers in Turkey occurred, it was a battle of trying to curry favor with particularly and seeking control of Fenerbahce in Istanbul. That's one. Two, with regard to the ultras, there is a trend, and again, this goes beyond soccer, but it has a significant impact on soccer. There is a trend in the Middle East, certainly among the autocratic regimes, but it's also true for Turkey, in which ultras are being criminalized as part of a process in which dissent and opposition is portrayed as the first step towards terrorism. In fact, if you look at a video, it's a 55-second video that was produced by the Anti-Terrorism Office of the Prime Minister. It shows a young girl who is protesting peacefully on Taksim Square in Istanbul, and shortly thereafter you see her being dressed up in a suicide vest. And the ultras in both Turkey and Egypt are under serious pressure. In Turkey, that means that 20 members of Çarşı at this moment, Çarşı being the support group of Beşiktaş in Istanbul, and probably the most popular and strongest fan group in the country, that 20 members have been charged with being members of an illegal organization. Turkey has further tried to control the pitch by banning the chanting of slogans, political slogans, during matches. That has so far failed. It has also tried to impose that anybody entering the stadium during a match sign a declaration in which he vows to adhere by that ban. Clubs have not been able to impose that. So that's my reading of what the current situation is.
One thing I'd like to add also is the fact that it seems like with the recent events in Istanbul, around the park, that fans of the three main teams in Istanbul actually banded together to a large extent. There's some nice photographs of, you know, fans of the different teams draped in each other's colors, which, considering the animosity and the long historical baggage that those teams carry and the animosity that many fans have towards each other, that was quite surprising. One theme that we also talk about a little bit in the introduction and also in the afterword is the role of religion. That is, you know, there are a lot of similarities between the way the game developed in the Middle East and other countries, but definitely the role of Islam in the region is something unique that you don't have in South America, obviously. As far as religion, even 100 years ago, there were debates, there were religious leaders, authorities that condemned the game outright. For the same reasons that you can imagine it being a Western import, taking people away from prayer, dressing immodestly, and so forth. And even 100 years ago, 120 years ago, there are reports of imams who liked the game and said, it's fine to play the game, maybe we have to wear longer pants, maybe we have to pray before the match. But from the beginning, it's interesting that there's been debate among Islamic authorities about the game, and that's only regarding men. With women, it's another dimension here. And actually, there have been quite a few recently, quite a few religious leaders, Islamic religious leaders in Gaza and Lebanon and elsewhere, who are great fans, and for them to imagine not having football played is inconceivable. But this, I think, I point out also in the introduction some areas I think which need more research, and one of them is definitely the relationship between soccer and religion. Maybe looking at studies of how religious. The role that religious institutions play, how the game takes on religious dimensions, also the connection to secularization. When the World Cup, I think the last World Cup or maybe the one before it in Saudi Arabia, people were staying away from prayers, so they brought mobile mosques or brought imams to to sort of lead prayers next to the cafes where the men were watching the game. And it is one of the stories we also include in the anthology is a section from an autobiographical novel by a former jihadist, and his book is called Life is More Beautiful in Paradise, a jihadist's own story. And in it, he talks about how soccer was used to recruit youth for the cause. And there have been Islamic leagues and the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, even a few months ago, were organizing tournaments with the goal of encouraging sport participation in sport, but also increasing religious devotion. So that's a pretty large area and one that hasn't been explored enough. If I mention research that is being done, I just want to say that there have been studies which you can find in studies of the psychology of sports or movement psychology and so forth by Iranian and Turkish scholars, and some of them study the attitudes of the mental makeup of Iranian goalkeepers. There are also studies of soccer tourism in Turkey. There's studies, physiological studies of the performance of Turkish amputee players. There's an interesting article study about sources of stress in Iranian referees, and like their brothers and sisters all over the world, being a referee is a pretty stressful occupation. So there are these kind of specific studies being done, but I would like to see, I teach religious studies, but and that's one reason I'm really interested in this, but considering how important Islam is in the region, we should have more studies about Islam and football.
Can I just add one thing?
Mm-hmm.
I think Alon is absolutely correct on the issue of religion. In a book that I have coming out shortly, I have a chapter on the religion. It's very current. There is huge debate within the Salafi community about religion. There is about soccer. There are diametrically opposed views within the jihadist community, and frankly, people like Osama bin Laden, or for that matter, Hassan Nasrallah, or Ismail Haniyeh in Gaza are moderates on this issue because they recognize the bonding and recruitment value of soccer. And the last example I want to note is there's a battle going on right now. You know, many of you may have followed what happened in Egypt this week with a player of Al Ahly showing the four-finger Rabah sign that is the symbol of the opposition to the military in Egypt, and identified with the Muslim Brotherhood, and he has now been basically fired from Al Ahly and vilified. But there is a battle going on for control of the board of Al Ahly between the Brotherhood and the military. And keep in mind that Al Ahly is one of Africa's most popular teams with an estimated fan base of 50 million people.
There's also an interesting article, a study called Sport in Contemporary Islamic Law, which appears in the Islamic Law and Society Journal by two Israeli scholars. And that talks a lot about what James just mentioned also.
Before I turn to Igabo Chipande in Lusaka, Zambia, for the next question, I just want to point out that a special issue of the journal Iranian Studies came out quite some time ago in 2002, devoted to sports and games, that tackled some of the topics that you all have raised now. So you might want to look at that if you haven't already. It also contains a bibliography of sports and games in the Iranian world by Hushang Chehabi of Boston University.
And we tried to get him to contribute to our anthology, but he declined. So.
I know this is one of the many challenges of putting together an edited volume alone. So, Cipande in Lusaka, your question, please.
Yes, thank you very much. I really enjoyed reading these articles, and I saw a lot of similarities with the work I'm doing here in Zambia on football in Zambia, such as linkages with football being introduced, for example, in the Middle East around the same time on the whole continent of Africa, links with colonialism, nationalism, urbanism, state building, etc., etc. But I really enjoyed again the article on competition to host the World Cup, which brought about the issue of Arabic and African identities, and that kind of really highlighted the divisions. Apart from the similarities that I noticed, especially in the introduction article. This article brought out a lot of these differences with the Egyptians and the Moroccans being seen to have one foot in Africa and the other one in the Middle East. I was just wondering if there is any work that has been done kind of looking at the actual in terms of the similarities, in terms of the actual qualities of the game in the Middle East and in the whole continent of Africa, and in connection with the points that has just been raised on religion, for instance, with West Africa, where Islam is quite dominant as well.
Peter, maybe that's your question.
Sorry, I was temporarily unavailable. What was the crux of the question again?
I was just impressed with the kind of the World Cup similarities.
Yeah. Sorry. Okay.
The similarities between football in the Middle East and the whole continent of Africa. And I was wondering if there is any specific works that have been done, kind of that would link that bring out the similarities between football in the Middle East and in Africa, or especially West Africa, where Islam is quite dominant.
Okay, no, thank you. No, I was temporarily writing something down. Explicitly comparative, the only thing I know really is folks who've tried to look at questions of nationalism. So the role of the relationship between football and nationalism, with some comparisons between Africa, specifically North Africa, things like the FLN team during the struggle for independence against France. You'll remember that team also toured the Middle East, played many, many games throughout the Middle East, including in Iraq, if I'm not mistaken, and Syria and Jordan, etc. So that was quite important. And also, I think there might be a couple of studies of African players who are playing or have played in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. So migration and issues of how the sort of global economy of football has really started to transcend these spatial boundaries. But I don't know a heck of a lot more that's been done in that area. But I too, like Cipande, was struck by the similarities in the themes that were covered in many of these pieces. With the possible exception of the articles on the ultras, because we don't see that kind of phenomenon in sub-Saharan Africa very much at all. So that's we have supporters clubs, of course, but not the kind of tifosi and ultras that have a particular hierarchy, a particular style of choreography and presence in and out of the stadiums, as we see in places like Turkey, for instance, or Egypt.
I think the work of Amara, Mahfoud Amara, who's an Algerian scholar, very prolific and has wonderful work published. He teaches in England, Lancaster, I think. And he has a book called Sport, Politics, and Society in the Arab World, which he included, you know, Morocco, Tunisia, Libya, Algeria, and as well as Iraq, Iran, and so forth. actually Iran he omitted. He didn't include them as being an Arab country. But I think you might find his work interesting, Mahfoud Amara, A-M-A-R-A. And he's written a lot, not only, a lot is about marketing, business, the political history of the game, but also about, he has a recent article, Football Subculture and Youth Politics in Algeria, where he talks also about music, football, and so forth. So he, I think his work you might find interesting, and probably writing to him, he's very responsive and very generous with his knowledge and time. You could probably, you know, make some connections, and if you don't have his address, I'll be happy to give it to you.
Yeah, he was trying to make this session, but unfortunately, doesn't seem like he was able to. But definitely very, very interesting and important work that, that he's doing. Although I wish his book were a little cheaper so more folks could read it. But we have certainly access to the journal articles, which is great. I mean, in that article on the World Cup, there were interesting sort of racial and ethnic and national stereotypes that also came into play in discourses that I think play out in Africa in similar ways as that they do in parts of the Middle East. And here again, James and Alon are particularly well placed to comment on this, right? I mean, Westerners with little knowledge, and not just Westerners, I'd say outsiders in general, who are not familiar with the complex politics and societies of the Middle East, tend to oversimplify things. That essay pointed out, right, that in the context of North Africa, for instance, and its relationship to sub-Saharan Africa, there's a lot of tension. And you see this playing out in the Middle East as well, whether it's religious tensions or geographical or national tensions. How did Middle Eastern neighbors of and Gulf neighbors of Qatar, for example, perceive that bid? Do we know much about that? Has work been done in that respect? And did it strengthen the unity of Asian football's identity, if there is such a thing, or did it weaken it? Were there these particular stereotypes that were played on or constructed?
Aron, do you want to respond?
No, I just spoke, so it's your turn. Besides that,
Several things. I mean, I don't know that there's been any academic research done, but there has been academic research done on Arab-African relations and the whole role that slavery plays in perceptions of that. And I'd have no doubt that you would see that reflected in some of the attitudes on the football field. In fact, you had a recent incident in Iran, where, and also in, by the way, in Saudi Arabia, two incidents in which there was racism against black players, but there was also significant upheaval in response to that. With regard to Qatar, you cannot see the Qatari World Cup bid independently of Qatari foreign and defense policy, and what that does, and independent of Qatar's relationship, very complex relationship to Saudi Arabia, and as a result, also complex relationships with other Gulf states. I think overall, there's on the one hand a sense of pride that the Middle East, for the first time, is hosting a World Cup. And one of the world's probably two most foremost sporting events, but there is a great deal of resentment, one against about the fact that it is a Qatari event, as much as the Qataris would like to portray it as a Middle Eastern or Gulf event. It is a Qatari event, and the Qataris want to keep it that way, intrinsically linked to opposition with among a majority of Gulf states to Qatar's relationship to the Muslim Brotherhood, for example, which is a historic relationship, not an opportunistic one. and which many of the Gulf states see as a threat.
As far as Western perspectives, there have been some interesting studies over the years, and I mentioned them in the introduction, about how, for example, the World Cup game between the U.S. and Iran was portrayed in the American media. Was it used to show Iranians as insane? Was it used to show them as similar to us Americans? We also got, and I recommend that article, I mentioned it here in the introduction. We got, when we started the project a couple of years ago, we got an interesting essay by an American officer who was stationed in Iraq, and he wrote about how soccer is used in Iraq by the American Army. Unfortunately, the article was pretty much a hymn to the American Army and its noble causes, and he didn't want to listen to any of our suggestions, so we didn't include it. But I do mention in the afterword, there's been quite a lot of children's literature about Iraq where football appears, and there's an excellent study by a scholar named David Kieran, What Young Men and Women Do When Their Country is Attacked, Interventionist Discourse and Rewriting of Violence in Adolescent Literature of the Iraq War, and that appears in the Children's Literature Association Quarterly. And in it, he describes one of the works, which is by a young adult novel called Purple Heart by Patricia McCormick. And it's about an American soldier, and football appears quite a lot in that book. He's recovering from an injury. He's guilt-ridden over the death of an Iraqi boy that he and his fellow soldiers befriended. They gave them candy. They organized them into football teams. One of the American soldiers, when he sees the kids playing soccer, he says, "We're bringing these people America." And then in the hospital, when he's injured, this American soldier realizes that the young boy, Ali, was wearing new football shoes. So he concludes that the boy was actually working with the insurgents and was a spy. At the end of the book, the boy, Ali, is killed in an explosion, a bomb that he carries. The good soldier gives the ball to a little girl, she kicks it into the crayon blue sky. So in this particular story, there's a definite ideological bias here, as in everything we write, but definitely presenting football as a way that we're bringing progress to Iraq.
Yeah, that should be an entire other football scholars forum, I think. although the essay on female players in Iraqi Kurdistan did get into this in some mm-hmm. detail.
Mm-hmm.
We are now entering the final 10 minutes of this match, if you will. I'm asking the ones who are online whether they have any additional question, if they want to participate and ask a question. But are there folks who have additional questions who've spoken already? I see some people typing on the chat function there in Skype. There was a comment on Twitter. Liz and a couple of others have been tweeting while we were having this conversation. We have a database of scholars working on football on the website for the Football Scholars Forum. It would be great, Liz suggested, if we could build our list of people working on football in the Middle East. Can we try and organize that? Because it sounds like there's so much to do and there's so many fascinating topics, and it's fields that many of us are not familiar with. Any chance we could build that?
I would be happy to provide the names and also some of the films and literature I mentioned after I deal with all the Armenian hate mail that's been coming my way in the last hour. So.
I'd be happy to contribute too. There are quite a number of people who haven't been mentioned but should be included.
Right. Excellent. Because, the website footballscholars.org. I think it's a great way to, you know, build our network and to also continue these conversations and strengthen our partnerships when we're not meeting and when we're off doing our own thing, whether we're giving talks or teaching our courses or writing our articles. And, you know, there's also a nice group library, Zotero Library, which we've added a few things to in recent times. That's also really a great way to expand the resources that folks who are interested in the serious study of football and society can dip into. And I think, you know, football in the Middle East is certainly a section that needs to expand. So yet another resource that we can work on the website.
And since every phone call and every Skype call is recorded by the NSA, I hope they've enjoyed the show also.
Yes, and it's also recorded and put on our website, and and people do listen to it now and again, so that's great. So let's now start to bring the conversation to a close, maybe, as we're now in the 85th minute and the match official is consulting with the fourth official on the sideline on how many minutes of added time might be given. Alon or James, do you have some final comments for the group?
James, would you like to speak?
Peter, thank you for putting this together. I really thought it was a very worthwhile conversation. And I think, you know, as Alon has pointed out on a whole bunch of points, there are a great number of individuals, or a fair number of individuals, primarily scholars, a few journalists, who are looking at the region or countries in the region and the relationship between sports and politics. But there's nothing structural, and a lot of this is really at the beginning rather than well advanced. And so I think that discussions like this and putting a database together makes imminent sense. And books like with the one that Alon is putting together, much of, at least I've read the journal issue what I particularly like about that also is, and I think that that's important, is that it's not that Alon has, as do people like Mark Levine, by the way, inserted an important element in terms of literature, but also there's a whole music side to this. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind that the ultras in the Middle East, but also elsewhere, it's a whole artistic performance. It's graffiti, it's lyrics, it's songs, it's artwork, it's choreography with the TiVos, and while there's been a lot of work done on that of ultras elsewhere in the world, there's been very little done on it in terms of the Middle East and North Africa.
Yes, thank you, Peter, and thank you, everyone, for... Hello?
Yeah, we're
here. Okay, I heard some sound that indicated something was happening. But thank you all for participating. It's been, for me, it's been a wonderful experience working on this book, learning so much, encountering generosity from scholars. We've had some problems that get... for instance, when we tried to get permissions for some of the literary works from the American University Press in Cairo, we didn't hear from them for 5 months because they're located exactly in the center of events, and they're often, you know, people were camping out for months. So it took them 5 months sometimes to answer our emails. But it's been really an interesting experience, and it's definitely an area that people are starting to pay attention to, and I'm looking forward to all the great scholarship that is emerging. So thank you very much.
Okay, well, I think that concludes this edition of our Football Scholars Forum on Soccer in the Middle East. Thank you again, Alon, for a wonderful edited collection, and thank you to James. We read your blog on the turbulent world of soccer in the Middle East assiduously and
religiously.
Thank you. That's very gracious. And thank you all.
And so let's keep in touch. And our next session will be early December. It'll be a different kind of session with Jonathan Wilson, the well-known author and journalist who edits The Blizzard, among the numerous things that he does. And we'll be talking more in a roundtable format about the brave new world of soccer publishing in the digital era. So you'll be receiving more information about that in the coming days. And I'll also circulate a wrap-up of this session and hopefully get the audio recording and the Twitter timeline up too. And thanks again, everyone, for participating.
Thank you.